overwhelming. Everyone here is happy to see that these people have come back to their country. And the point is, we have to say and highlight the fact that what we see here is the result of the successful efforts of Iran's diplomatic, apparatus that has managed to defend the rights of all Iranians across the world, as the foreign minister of Iran previously, Mr. Hamid Abdullahian, said regarding this event, this swap deal. And by the way, it's all related to humanitarian issues, and it has got nothing to do with anything else. Although the Western media has tried to, put this fact that Iran has managed to free its, nationals from U.S. prisons, those who were held under the pretext of, violating sanctions that were illegal, inhumane, that have affected the livelihoods of Iranians. What we can see here is that it's absolutely beautiful that these people are back in our country. Now, while the Western media is trying to just explain and, narrate a different story, a narrative that says Iranian individuals, this deal is related to the release of Iran's frozen assets in South Korea. However, this has got nothing to do with that.
1 month after reaching a deal mediated by Qatar, the U.S. and Iran each released five prisoners sought by the other. The five U.S. detainees left Tehran aboard a Qatari plane for Doha, en route to their country. All were arrested on charges of espionage and collaborating with foreign governments. The U.S. citizens freed include Siam Aknamazi, Emma Charghi, and Murad Tahbaz. The identities of the other two have not been disclosed. The five Iranian prisoners were identified as Mehrdad Moin Ansari, Kambiz Attar Kashani, Reza Sarhangpur Kofrani, Amin Hassanzadeh, and Kaveh Lutfullah Afrasiabi. They were held in American jails illegally under the pretext of violating U.S. sanctions.
After a successful teamwork, five innocent Iranians held in U.S. prisons were freed today. Two of them are on the way to Tehran via Doha. Iran's Human Rights Council is determined to uphold the rights of Iranian nationals abroad in cooperation with the executive and judiciary powers.
Tehran has repeatedly urged Washington to release innocent Iranian nationals who have been taken hostage on baseless charges of bypassing U.S. sanctions, decrying Washington for tying the humanitarian issue with other issues, including the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal.
I mean, this is a type of blackmailing, you know, this is kind of like mafia work, but within a government, and this is what the U.S. does, right? They arrest people, they put, unjust charges, they fabricate charges, and this is their way of trying to bully the Islamic Republic of Iran and weaken them. But the Islamic Republic of Iran, thankfully with their leadership and the supreme leader, they're not giving in, and they're not bowing down, and they're not being submissive, and they're fighting for their rights.
A few minutes after the release of the prisoners, U.S. President Joe Biden slapped fresh sanctions on Iran, sending a message of continued enmity towards the Islamic Republic. The sanctions on Iran's intelligence ministry and former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad were imposed over the alleged disappearance of Bob Levinson, a former FBI agent. Levinson reportedly visited Iran's southern Kish Island on March 2007. He later went missing, and his whereabouts have remained unknown ever since. Tehran and Washington have many unresolved issues which lay barriers in their ties, such as the heavy unilateral sanctions imposed unjustly by the U.S. Iran has time and again expressed readiness to put aside differences and resolve issues via diplomatic ways, such as this case.
We've spoken to Masoud Shajara, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. He says Iran's accepting the prisoner swap is in line with its commitments to protecting its citizens across the world.
Well, this is significant, it's very important, and it's actually in line with what Iran has committed itself to its citizens since the beginning of the revolution. Prior to that, there wasn't really much interest in the protecting the citizens of Iran. But now we have seen since the revolution that has been one of the main commitments of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the fact that this sort of exchange is taking place at the time when there is very little communication, no direct communication, it actually means that there is a very sophisticated sort of negotiation behind the scene indirectly, which resulted in this. And I think it really is good, because it's good for sort of those who have found themselves unjustly imprisoned in the United States. It's good to stop the sort of illegal and barbaric actions of United States in putting those sanctions on Iran and creating something which is a sort of a law of jungle, and enforcing and bullying the international community. It sort of shows that despite what the U.S. thinks, still it could be held accountable.
Some $6 billion of Iranian assets that have been frozen in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions have been transferred to the accounts of Iranian banks in Qatar. The funds are now under the control of Iran's central bank and will be spent based on the country's needs and priorities. That's according to a statement by Iran's foreign ministry. The ministry denounced as illegal and inhumane Washington's measures to prevent Iran from having access to its financial resources in other countries. The statement said those governments that have blocked Iran's assets must also be held accountable because of unjustifiably complying with illegal U.S. demands. It added that the move has caused financial and humanitarian damage in Iran, especially during the COVID pandemic. The Iranian funds have remained blocked in two South Korean banks since 2018. Iraq has vowed that it will not allow any threat from its Kurdistan region to Iran based on the security agreement between the two countries. The Iraqi foreign minister, Fuad Hussein, made the pledge during a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian. The meeting was held on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. The two neighbors have reached an agreement to disarm and to relocate anti-Iran terrorist groups operating in Kurdistan region, northern Iraq. Baghdad says Kurdish armed groups along the border with Iran have handed over their heavy weaponry before the deadline for the deal, which is September 19. Iraq says the groups will be relocated to 5 camps in Kurdistan, but far away from Iran's border. Iran has said that it will not extend the deadline. In Bahrain, people have once again taken to the streets to show their anger at Manama's normalization of relations with the Israeli regime. Holding banners reading "normalization, failure, and humiliation," the protesters criticized the kingdom for establishing diplomatic ties with Tel Aviv. The Monday night protests came more than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime opened its embassy in the Persian Gulf Arab state. The Bahraini people have repeatedly held such demonstrations to express their opposition to such a move. Back in 2020, Bahrain, along with the United Arab Emirates, inked the U.S. brokered normalization deals with Israel. Morocco and Sudan followed suit and joined the accord later. The move by the Arab countries has drawn criticism from many Muslim countries. Palestinians, who have been facing Israeli crimes almost on a daily basis, have decried the deals as a stab in the back. The Israeli regime has extended the closure of the Erez pedestrian crossing with Gaza under the pretext of recent protests along the barrier bordering the coastal territory. Erez is the sole crossing for people, including patients who need to travel to the occupied West Bank. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, for more details.
The first 2 days as of Friday were allegedly for the Jewish holiday of the Jewish New Year, or the Rosh Hashanah. But today and yesterday, the Israeli regime kept the crossing sealed because the Israeli military says it's a punishment for the Palestinians in Gaza for the protests that were taking place along the security fence to slam the attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds and the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protest has been taking place over the last at least a week now. So it is possible that the Israeli regime will keep the crossing closed maybe for longer than it has been so far. So for 4 days, more than 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, none of them is allowed to reach the occupied West Bank or Al-Quds, whether for personal reasons or for medical treatment. The Israeli regime has two crossings into the Gaza Strip, the Kerem Shalom and in southern Gaza. It's a commercial crossing, and the Erez crossing in northern Gaza, which is a pedestrian crossing. Every year, Tel Aviv keeps these crossing seals for more than 150 days. Patients were the hardest hit by this situation. There's lack of medicines. Most permits are denied by the Israeli regime, and even those who are granted permits to leave, for example, the Erez crossing, their transport is hindered by Israeli forces. There's a lack of agricultural supplies in Gaza because the Gaza Strip fertile land is not enough to feed more than 2 million inhabitants in the Gaza Strip. So Gaza depends on import of fruits and vegetables. And now with this situation, with the closure of the crossings, you get the prices increase because there's demand and there is no supply.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned Israeli settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under the protection of the regime forces. The OIC said that Israeli incursions into Al-Aqsa, almost on a daily basis, are a clear violation of the Geneva Convention and international law. The organization also called on the international community to hold Israel accountable and to put an end to the regime's atrocities across the occupied territories. On Sunday, Israeli settlers, backed by troops, stormed Al-Aqsa once again, provoking Palestinians' anger. Palestinian resistance groups say that Al-Aqsa Mosque is their red line and that any aggression against it will face a strong response. Tensions between India and Canada have been simmering after Ottawa accused New Delhi of being involved in the killing of a Canadian Sikh leader in June. Ottawa and New Delhi have both expelled senior diplomats from their countries in a tit-for-tat move. The Indian Foreign Ministry has called the allegations absurd and motivated. The ministry also urged Ottawa to take legal action against anti-Indian elements operating from Canadian soil. Canada, however, is accusing India of violating its sovereignty by murdering a Canadian citizen. Sikh separatist leader Hardeep Singh Najjar was found dead in a suburb of Vancouver on June 18. He was an advocate for an independent Sikh state to be carved out of parts of northern India and part of Pakistan. France and Germany have expressed support for a new migrant action plan proposed by the European Commission, which aligns with Italy's tough approach on migration. Now, last week, more than 7,000 migrants reached one of Italy's islands in just 2 days. Max Giavelli has more from Rome.
After years of negotiations, the European Commission has finally taken a position on the migrant issue, the harshest one. Brussels will, in fact, back the Italian far-right government's hardline stance on migration. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has welcomed a 10-point plan on migrants presented by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in Lampedusa on Sunday.
I'm confident the issue of migration will be added to the agenda of the next EU summit in October. We must stop departures from Africa and swiftly deport those turned down for asylum. The future of Europe is at stake here.
Following a surge in migrant arrivals on Italy's shores, von der Leyen visited the southern island of Lampedusa on Sunday, where the situation has been tense since the start of the year, with thousands of migrants stranded in difficult conditions. Here, von der Leyen announced a new migrant action plan, which includes fighting trafficking, returning migrants to the countries of origin, and transferring migrants from Italy to other EU member states.
It is very important for me because irregular migration is a European challenge and it needs a European answer. So we are in this together.
Germany has promptly expressed its support for another proposal made by the European Commission President von der Leyen that concerns expanding air and naval surveillance of the European Union's external borders. Some experts are of the idea that such a measure would be against international maritime law, as EU ships would not be allowed to operate in territorial zones where only North African states have jurisdiction.
Air and naval surveillance of the Mediterranean by the EU would be equivalent to a warlike act. We all know what has happened to Libya after the French-led NATO attack there. All migrants' countries of origin must be involved in a more democratic process of handling the migrants. Also, von der Leyen's 10-point plan on migrants is full of inconsistencies.
Meanwhile, French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin made a lightning visit to Italy on Monday. In an interview to a French radio, Darmanin said that France is willing to help Italy to secure its borders, but it will not take in any migrants from the island of Lampedusa. Max Civili, Rome.
And that is with this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Over 5 million more American children were plunged into poverty in 2022 after stimulus provisions expired. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truth Out, new data shows that child poverty in the United States of America skyrocketed in 2022 after lawmakers allowed pandemic stimulus provisions to expire, leaving millions to languish even as the pandemic and its economic consequences raged on. According to the Census Bureau's latest report on poverty in the U.S., the supplemental poverty rate among children more than doubled between 2021 and 2022, jumping from 5.2% to 12.4% in just 1 year. This represents an increase of over 5 million children experiencing poverty in 2022, for a total of about 9 million children. Poverty also increased for all ages by 4.6 percentage points to 12.4% in 2022. This marks the first increase in the supplemental poverty rate since 2010 and marks the largest one-year rise in poverty rates on record, according to the Census Bureau. The agency says the incident was due to the expiration of provisions like the expanded child tax credit, which provided families with children extra money each month. the expanded Earned Income Tax Credit, EITC, and the end of the stimulus payments. The expansions of the Child Tax Credit and EITC both ended in 2021. After helping to keep millions of individuals and families afloat during the first 2 years of the pandemic. Due in large part to these provisions and the stimulus checks, the supplemental poverty rate hit an all-time low of 7.8% among all ages in 2021, the Census Bureau found. Inflation also played a major role in household finances. As inflation rose 7.8% between 2021 and 2022, a record increase, household median income fell by 2.3% in real dollars, meaning that they were adjusted for inflation. This roughly matches the decrease in workers' wages in real dollars of 2.2%. The official poverty rate remained flat at 11.5%. The official rate is calculated differently from the supplemental rate and is considered to be outdated because it doesn't take into account aid from some of the most significant anti-poverty programs like Social Security or basic costs like utilities or shelter. Findings demonstrate the long-time progressive adage that poverty is a policy choice and that U.S. lawmakers can implement policies that would reduce or eliminate poverty if they chose to do so. Sharon Parrott, president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, said in a statement recently, "The rise in the poverty rate, the largest on record in over 50 years, both overall and for children, underscores the critical role that policy choices play in the level of poverty and hardship in the U.S. Parrott emphasized that even if Congress had only kept extending the expanded child tax credit, it could have kept 3 million children out of poverty in 2022, or over half of the children who were plunged into poverty last year. Other attempts to revive the credit were rejected by Democrats and Republicans alike. ABC News also reported in 2022 the poverty rate in the U.S. was 12.4%, up 4.6% from 2021, according to the Supplemental Poverty Measure, SPM, which looks at government programs and tax credits designed to help low-income families, according to the census. The expiration of pandemic programs, including refundable tax credits and stimulus payments at the start of 2022, led to an increase in the SPM over the official poverty rate, the census reported. The poverty rate among children saw a sizable increase, more than doubling from 5.2% in 2021 to 12.4% last year, census data shows. The official poverty rate for Black Americans decreased by 2.4% from 19.5% in 2021 to 17.1% in 2022, according to census data, as well as for Asian Americans, which saw the official poverty rate dip from 9.1% in 2021 to 8.6% last year. White Americans experienced a 0.5% increase in poverty from 2021 to 2022, which sits at 10.5%, census data shows. The official poverty rate measures poverty by comparing pre-tax income to a poverty threshold, adjusted by family composition, according to the Census Bureau.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Press Review Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. A prisoner exchange has taken place between Iran and the United States. Five Iranian nationals were released from the U.S. and five Americans were released from Iran. This after the two countries reached an agreement, which was mediated by Qatar. And one last note, right after the exchange took place, the U.S. announced new sanctions against Iran, but of course. Well, we're going to be looking at this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Daniel McAdams, Executive Director, Ron Paul Institute, Lake Jackson, Texas. And Christopher Helani, Research and Political Analyst out of Vermont. Thank you both for being with me on this program. Well, let me start this off with Daniel. How is it that Washington continues to use unilateral sanctions and it is excuse for arresting Iranians when even the United Nations has said that unilateral sanctions are illegal according to international law?
Well, legal and illegal according to international law doesn't mean too much to the neocons who run Washington, D.C. I think the bigger question is why continue to do something that doesn't work? That seems to be the only arrow in the quiver of the United States is sanctions. Sanctions don't work. In fact, they're counterproductive, as we see in the reorientation of the world because of U.S. sanctions. We see Iran being driven back to friendship with Saudi Arabia. We see China and Russia. They're all the victims of the U.S. sanctions in the world are now getting together, and it makes up a majority of the population of the world. So they have absolutely the opposite effect of what they're supposed to have.
Christopher, Iran has said that the Americans were guilty of sedition and spying. Is that difficult to believe when we look at the constant foreign interference inside of Iran and attempts to overthrow the government here?
Listen, of course, the United States will take citizens of any nation that are deemed a threat, and that's just on the playbook. But of course, the United States has leveled claims against Iran, saying that these people were illegally detained and so on and so forth. However, we know full well from history, not only in recent history, but going back to the coup in early 1950s, that the United States uses all methods and tactics to ensure regime change operations succeed. And so they've used even the most benign actors to try to force regime change. So obviously, both sides have hurled accusations towards one another that they are taking people illegally and against international law. But what remains true is that Iran has had no aggression towards the United States. But the United States and its allies in the region continually embark on a program of aggression, on sanctions. And so I think that's very important to understand here.
Well, Daniel, in your perspective, how important is this agreement that was reached?
Well, I am a huge critic of President Biden. I think his foreign policy is an absolute disaster. I think he's surrounded himself with horrific neocons that are bringing us on the verge of World War III. With that said, I think this is one of the only really, really great things that he's done as president. It's an absolute no-brainer to me. And the fact that both neocons on the Republican side and Democrat side in Washington, D.C. are gnashing their teeth just reinforces to me the wisdom of this. And it's not because I frankly, I know the specifics of either case of either side. It's a good deal. Iran gets some of its own money back, which the United States government stole, and 10 people will now be able to enjoy time with their own families rather than sitting in prison cells. It's a win-win. I would like to say it would be nice if it were the beginning of an opening toward a dialogue with Iran. But of course, as you started the show by saying, we turned around and slapped more sanctions on it. So you know, one step forward, two steps back. But the Biden administration and even Blinken, the biggest warmonger in the U.S., deserves some credit for this deal because everyone hates them for doing it.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Christopher, let's talk about the role of Qatar in helping to implement this deal and the significance in general of strengthening ties between Iran and its neighbors.
I think for sure that the region is experiencing seismic shifts in terms of their dealings with multiple international partners. Historically, Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the UAE and other countries have been aligned with the United States. However, since the resumption of diplomatic ties, as was mentioned earlier, with Iran and Saudi Arabia, facilitated by China, we're seeing that these countries are playing an active role towards de-escalation, towards regional peace and cooperation, and towards the rule of law in the region. And that means not only abiding by what the United States wants, but serving the interests in a much broader sense. And so Qatar facilitating this this exchange is huge for them. It's a victory in terms of foreign policy. It's a victory for peace and stability in the region. And of course, it comes on the heels of some amazing diplomatic work that other countries have done, like China. So I think that here it should be celebrated that this has occurred. And of course, that the exchange of money, which was rightfully the Iranian people's wealth, has gone back to them. And I think that this is a key to understand that this isn't money that's been gifted to Iran. This is Iran's own money that was blocked by sanctions leveled on Iran and on other countries due to this economic coercion and warfare that we've seen deemed sanctions. So I think that this is a big diplomatic coup. And I think that we're going to see more of this, I hope, as the region experiences transformations in this post-war on terrorism phase.
Well, Dan, you just heard Christopher talk about $6 billion of Iran's money that was transferred in connection with this deal. Now, when we look at mainstream media, we see it being presented as if there was some ransom paid. No one talks about the illegality to begin with of basically stealing or freezing Iran's money. Let's talk about that. I mean, what is the goal of all of this, to create this narrative in the way the mainstream media does it?
Well, you know, the U.S. accuses others of doing that which it does itself. You know, there's the accusation that, where in fact it's in the United States that the mainstream media absolutely 100%, as you suggested, follows the U.S. government line, follows the neocon line, the deep state line. There is absolutely no possibility for anyone to go against it. And I think it says a lot, you know, that we have a problem in the U.S. We need to look at ourselves in the mirror and understand that we are replicating that which we claim that others are doing. We blame others for doing is happening in the U.S. And as you point out, this $6 billion is an exact example. You'll find nowhere in any part of the mainstream media that will talk about the fact that this is money that was taken by President Trump in one of his stupidest moves, which is pulling out of the Iran deal, taken by President Trump and frozen in South Korea. Nobody likes having their money stolen. Here's a news flash to the U.S. and to the U.S. population. No one likes their money stolen.
Right, right. Well, Christopher, what do you make of immediately following the prisoner exchange, as I said earlier, then the U.S. put more sanctions on Iran? I mean, what does that mean? And this time around, it was the former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and the intelligence ministry right after that. Your assessment, it's quite mind-boggling. I don't know. You tell me.
It's mind-boggling. And this is, of course, due to what was just mentioned, this extreme pressure from the media, from the neocons, from the war hawks, from the foreign policy elite, and, this elite establishment that in Washington, that, of course, says this was a ransom payment. You have to do more. You have to go against them. And let's not forget the Zionist lobby. Let's not forget the Israeli lobby in Washington that, of course, is very much against any deals with Iran. And so what you see here is red meat to the other side, this sort of bipartisanship that they always talk about. This is the bipartisanship. We gave a deal with Iran. Now we have to slap sanctions on them. So we have to, carrot and stick sort of scenario here. And I think that it's really important to recognize that without real strong and effective leadership that advocates for peace, for justice, and for a new, overall framework of relations between the U.S. and Iran, this is going to continue. We're going to continue to have an aggressive policy. And Biden, of course, should have gone back to the JCPOA. He didn't because of that extreme pressure that emerged from the Trump administration's pulling out of the JCPOA and a tremendous amount of lobbying. So, of course, the sanctions that come on the heels of this successful deal are a result of that and are a result of the climate that exists, which is very hostile towards Iran, really an Iranophobia, if you want to put it that way. And I think that what we have to do is we have to de-escalate this and we have to tell people the truth about the relations and the truth that the United States continues to embark on a policy of trying to overthrow the legitimate government in Tehran and trying to still meddle in the affairs of a sovereign and independent state. This is intolerable for any country. And so I think that we have to really highlight this, and we have to recognize that these sanctions are a result of this policy circle that surrounds the president and the executive branch, and of course is financed from many different sides, especially the Zionist lobby.
Well, what about that, Daniel? I mean, Christopher said that what is needed is a new administration adhering to peace. Is that possible? Because, I mean, if we look at the history, let's say, of Iran-U.S. relations since 1979, there's been a lot of hostility out of Washington and trying to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Is it something that is actually possible? Because what Christopher talked about are the various lobbying groups, the various entities that actually controls policy in Washington. Is it possible for the American people to actually vote for someone who would become president and believe in peace?
Well, I would like to think there is, but when I look at all the candidates, they're all agreed on these issues when it comes to Iran. And sadly, even RFK Jr., who's very good on peace, has taken a very, very unnecessarily hardline pro-Israel stance. It's not necessary. You can still be a friend of that country without doing what he's done. So right now, there really isn't a lot of hope. And I think, basically, that's okay. We're not going to, as you point out, the uniparty in D.C. That's backed up by the Israel lobby, that is powered by the military-industrial complex, that powers the think tanks, that tell us who our enemies are, tells the media who our enemies are. We have a deeply corrupt system in the United States, and it's going to be very difficult to repair relations. And that's why I think people need to stand up and say, Biden did a good job on this. This is a smart thing. It's politically extremely difficult for him to do this right now as we're moving into an election system, a season. He's going to be hit from all sides. I don't care if he did it for the wrong reasons or the right reasons. It's the right thing to do, and it's a good step. And let's just hope that it's the beginning of more steps, because there's no reason to not have better relations. Nothing that we have done since 79 has worked, as you point out. In fact, it's been counterproductive.
Well, Christopher, do you see the timing of the new sanctions against Iran indicative of a schism in general inside of the United States, or is it simply indicative of the schizophrenic policy of the Biden administration? I mean, how do you see it? What's going on?
I was going to mention that it's schizophrenia. You're absolutely right. I think it's a constantly this ebb and flow between the fact that we have a uniparty, we have these two parties, and anybody who disagrees with the mainstream narrative, the main line, especially towards Iran, is relegated to the side, even if it's a sane and just position, even if it's a position that's in the interest of the United States. Like you see, Biden made this move, the rationales of which, you know, aren't necessary, as was mentioned, and aren't as important. But what is important is that this was a good diplomatic move and actually ensures safety, a greater safety and security for the United States. And what ends up happening, everybody gets upset. And so instantly we go to the other extreme, you know, according to the U.S. establishment, which is put sanctions on them. I think that Biden's going to be hit hard because of this, and already it's happening on social media, and you'll see it in the upcoming political cycle, which we are well into now. And I think that the response will be, well, we put more sanctions on Iran to kind of placate this idea. Mm-hmm. But that's the problem with having a country that is governed by not only lobbyists, but by a war. It's really a war machine. It's a military-industrial complex whose main goal is to instigate and perpetuate conflict for its own enrichment and to do its fiduciary responsibility to its shareholders. And so, of course, if you're operating by that logic, peace isn't in the equation. What's in the equation is regime change. And that's the real danger that lurks beneath the U.S. political establishment and U.S. foreign policy. And so without changing that, we will not see a real change and a real success in terms of diplomacy. That will be left to China, to Russia, to the BRICS countries, to the new multipolar world emerging in the global south. And they will be, it will be to the credit of them to ensure peace and stability in the region, where the U.S. cannot do that and is not in their DNA to do that.
Well, Daniel, are the Americans caught up in this, an old West mentality, and simply want to look tough to the world? Because in actuality, we know that new sanctions against Iran really not going to make a difference. And as you had alluded to already, the sanction regime obviously does not work. So what is it?
You know, you do have an American population that's very, very propagandized. They're hit on all sides by state media that pretends to be private media. And so they don't see what the cost of the $1.5 trillion war machine. We spend $1.5 trillion, as my colleague Christopher said, on the U.S. war machine every year. And they're being sold that it makes us tough, it makes us respected. We can't dare to show any weakness around the world. But the reality is we're becoming weak because we spend so much money. We have $33 trillion in debt. All that debt has to be monetized, and it's monetized on the back of American workers. Now, they don't see it directly, but they see it through the hidden and cruel tax of inflation. Their dollar buys less. So they're paying more and more to this war machine that only enriches the people who are among the elites in Washington, D.C., and their environs. So my approach has always been to try to convince Americans that you're being robbed to pay very, very rich people in Washington to put your lives in danger for World War III.
And Chris, final thoughts. Do you see a change on the horizon at all between, for example, Tehran and Washington, and what would it take?
I mean, I'm always hopeful, of course, of a change, especially as an Iranian American. Always hopeful that there can be some sense in Washington to ease tensions and to resume diplomatic ties, to resume the JCPOA, to get rid of all of these economic coercive measures and sanctions, and to really bring the people together. Because I think the U.S. People, as was rightly stated by my colleague, are so propagandized. Whereas the Iranian people always say, and even Iran's leadership always says, we love the people in the U.S., but we hate the government. And that's the key here. It's not the people in the U.S. who understand this situation. It's those in Washington who are governing the situation. I don't see a change on the horizon. I hope so. My hope is actually that the change is going to be forced because of the situation that's changing geopolitically in the region, that China and Russia are getting more involved and invested in peace and in security in the Middle East, and that the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran and the failure now of the deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel will ultimately mean that the Zionist lobby will be unable to continue to propagandize about this because it's just not politically sound. It's okay. Not geopolitically sound.
And on that note, I have to thank both of you. We're out of time. Daniel McAdams, Executive Director, Ron Paul Institute, Lake Jackson, Texas. Christopher Helali, researcher and political analyst out of Vermont. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan.
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of isma, or roughly it could be translated to English as infallibility. So, this type of attribute is given to whom, and why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has not given infallibility or isma to everyone. First, define isma for us. What is it exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Isma, or infallibility, is discussed in theological books, the books of Kalam. Regarding the prophets and the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam and Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha. So according to all Muslims, the prophets, and according to the Shia, next to them, and I mean the prophets and the Imams, 12 Imams and Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, are infallible, they are ma'soon. Meaning that they're not going to commit any sin, and they are not going to make mistakes. Of course, there are differences of ideas about the details. I will explain some of them. So Hisma is a concept which referring to the fact that an infallible person is not going to commit sins or make mistakes. Now, the differences, because when it comes to infallibility or hisma, the question is that, is it just for major sins or for both major sins and minor sins?
Yes.
We know that the Noble Book of Quran refers to the fact that sins are divided into two parts, major ones, minor ones. Among especially Sunni scholars, we have some scholars who believe that the prophets may commit minor sins. But according to the Shia scholars, the famous viewpoint is that no, the prophets and the imams are free from both major sins and minor sins. This is one point.
Yes.
The second point is that the question is that, are the prophets and imams, they are infallible only after the time they are chosen as the prophet and the imams, or even they are infallible before that time? So, mm-hmm. For example, our holy prophet is chosen as the last prophet when he was 40 years old. The question is that, was he infallible before that time as well, or no, just from that time onwards? Again, among Sunni scholars, we have some who believe that the concept of infallibility regarding the prophets is limited to the time that they are chosen as the prophet, not before that. So before that, they may commit some sins, especially minor sins. But again, the
Shia... You mean mistakes or sins?
No, we are talking about minor sins.
Minor sins, okay.
But again, the famous idea among the Shia scholars is that no, the prophets are infallible. They are not going to commit any sin, both before and after the time they are chosen as the prophet. And the same is true for the imams. They are infallible even before the time they are chosen as the imams.
That's right.
The next issue is about making mistakes, or what some people call it Sahwun Nabi. Again, we have some scholars, especially among Sunnis, who believe that the prophets may commit some mistakes. We are talking about, making mistakes unwillingly, sahv, or forget something.
For example, losing the address of the house, yeah. Going to the wrong directions, yeah. Or for example, this and that, okay?
So we have some group of Muslim scholars among Sunnis who believe that, and few scholars among the Shia, but again, the famous idea among the Shia scholars is that they are not going to make mistakes in even their everyday life. Now, the question is that, because the question asks why we are not going to reach infallibility. The point is that hisma or infallibility for the prophet or imam, let's forget about all the differences. All the Muslims believed in some type of infallibility for the prophets and the Shia for the imams of the Ahl Bayt alayhi salam as well. The question is that, are these people given this infallibility by God without them doing any action? This is inherent in them, or they acquire infallibility? Okay?
Yes.
So some people may say that if I was a prophet, I had infallibility as well. No, this is not the case. Infallibility is given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because the people... already show through their actions that they're not going to commit any sin. My point is that still the prophets and the imams, they have free will.
Yes.
It's not the case that they do not have free will. They are forced just to do good actions, and they are forced not to do any wrong action, not to commit any sin. No, they have free will, and they decide not to commit any sin. Okay? So that is one point. We shouldn't think that the imams, the prophets, they do not have any free will and they are different from us. And that is why we are not able to be infallible. Allah has chosen them, and they are forced not to do and not to commit any sin. This is not true.
Okay.
So what is the reason for them not to commit any sin? It has two reasons. One of them is their ilm or knowledge, and the second point is their insight or taqwa or God-weariness.
Yes.
So when you have the knowledge of, divine teachings, you come to know that you see the realities of this world.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Praises to Allah, all glories to Allah. We
worship Allah and no one but Allah. Now imagine that if each and every person, when he or she is going to backbite, they see that they are going to eat the flesh of a dead body, as mentioned in chapter Hujurat.
Yes.
For sure, in that case, they are not going to commit that sin. I mean, you cannot imagine any person to eat the from the meat of the flesh of a dead body.
Yes.
But the point is that as fallible human beings, we are not seeing the realities of this world.
Mm-hmm.
So we may backbite. But when it comes to imams, when it comes to the prophets, because of their actions, because of their knowledge, they see the realities of this world. So for each and every sin, when they see the reality, for sure they are not going to commit that sin. And this is the difference between us and them. Are they forced? No, they are not forced. But through their knowledge, through their actions, they have come to this level that they can see some realities of this world. This is one point. The other point is that now the question is that what about us? Are we able to reach infallibility or not? The answer is yes and no. What do I mean? When it comes to receiving one type of infallibility, we can say that it's forced by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, one type of isma or infallibility, we can claim that it is, out of the free will of the prophets. The point is that according to Islamic theology, especially the Shia Kalam, when it comes to receiving the revelation, the prophets are not going to make any mistakes.
Yes.
And this is, done directly by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Somehow, in this case, they do not have any free will, because this is for giving the revelation, for giving the religion to the prophets. So for receiving the revelation, they are not going to make any mistakes. For understanding the revelation, again, they are not going to make any mistakes. And then for delivering the revelation to the people, to teach the people, they are not going to make any mistake. So, for example, the Holy Prophet, when he is receiving the verses of the Quran from the Archangel Jibreel, he is not going to make a mistake. And this is willed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And for himself, understanding the revelation, he is not going to make any mistake. And then when he is going to recite the verses for the people, he is not going to make any mistake. And this is done by the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But when it comes to his daily life, for his, daily actions, he is not going to commit any sin completely based on his free will. Now, the difference between the prophets, and the question is that now, are we able to reach infallibility or not? As I said, yes and no. Mm-hmm. What do I say no? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has chosen the prophets and the imams because